Thank you very much to the Royal Aeronautical Society for this invitation. It is indeed a privilege. And what I like to do today is to provide a perspective. And I like to launch that perspective. You know, I don't think there is anything more incredibly difficult than making an accurate reading of the present time. We're immersed in it. And the realities of daily life lead us to decisions that, in hindsight, they appear to be not as good as they were at the time we made them. And the courses of action that we charted as consequence of that reading of the present day sometimes may not look so smart as they did at the point in time in which we took them. So it's an important thing to take into account when we make retrospective analysis. And I believe that retrospective analysis should not be about judgment, but description, in trying to understand why we made the decisions that we made at that particular point in time based on available knowledge and based on existing beliefs. So after that brief intro, back as the 70s were switching and progressing into the 80s, we had problems in aviation, we thought. We had a safety concern, and that safety concern was that people, and by people I mean frontline operators who were engaged in the delivery of services for which the organizations to which they belonged were in business, people were making things that they were not supposed to do, or people were doing things that they should not, that they should have done, either way. So we took a reading of that situation, and that reading led us to conclude, as an industry, that we had a problem with human error. So, in a way, what this reading, this was a milestone reading. This was a reading that branded an entire generation of aviation safety professionals, our generation. We launched into a campaign to address human error from every conceivable angle. Containment, avoidance, management. And in the attempt, we might not have made a very clear differentiation between the broader field of human factors, the macro approach of human factors, and the micro approach of human performance. So because we're talking about people doing things they were not supposed to do or not doing things they were supposed to do, we took the narrower view of human performance and we launched into attempts to shape behaviors through training strategies. And thus, we came up with crew resource management. Crew resource management, based on behavioral stereotypes, it was a kind of off-the-shelf approach. And it's just one portion of the bigger human factors cake, which was addressed really in the 90s. In the 90s, we moved toward a contextual reading. We had the feeling for many years, human performance doesn't take place in a vacuum. Human performance takes place within a context. And that possibilities and constraints within the context provide a boundary to what humans can do. I think that the realization had been there for many years, and I think that throughout our CRM experience, we expressed that realization through attempts to reach to management. I mean, all of us who have been involved in resource management, it was this constant regret. Well, we're getting to the troops okay, but we need to get to management. And I think that what we're saying is we need to get to management because, after all, it is management which, through the allocation of resources, shapes the context, which then shapes human behavior. Now, we might not have been articulating the situation in those terms, but I think that's what we're trying to say. Now, nothing is more helpful to understand the complexities of situations than a good model. And I think that all the frustrations that we experienced during the 80s as crew resource management practitioners were due in part because we didn't have a model that would help to reduce the complexities of a very difficult situation into something which was visually easy to acquire. And I think that that's what Jim's model gave us. Jim's model gives us a way to understand in a visual manner the way context shapes human performance. So what we understood was that through crew resource management, we could address actions and inactions. And through crew resource management, we could address how actions and inactions could penetrate system defenses, but crew resource management by itself would not address context. So clearly, there was a need to start somehow addressing context. But again, we didn't know how. The tools were not there because, again, throughout our human performance endeavors, we had been locked on the tip of the arrow, mostly. Anyway, by the early 90s, we started looking at context. And we resorted what we had at hand because we didn't know any better. So we extended CRM to the Magna. We went, what started as cockpit resource management moved on to crew resource management, into team resource management, into maintenance resource management, into corporate resource management, and we started thinking about CRM as organizational development. And we started mixing flight crews with cabin crews and controllers and pilots and so on and so forth in trying to address the bigger picture. But it was naive in the sense that we were dragging a heavy historical background in terms of prescription. Few industries are so heavily regulated as the aviation industry. So ever since the first accident was investigated, we had our first regulation trying to address the problems that generated the accident. The massive introduction of technology in the 60s, 70s brought with it the incredible amount of regulations that we have, so that people know how to use the technology, and so that technology can be properly deployed. So this generated this perception that we could entirely pre-specify operational environments in the drawing board. That as subject matter experts, we could sit around the table before we would deploy a particular system, and we could anticipate at the drawing board stage, so to speak, all the actions and interacts, all the operational action and interaction that could take place. And therefore, that we could write rules and regulations to address those interactions, that we could deploy the technology that would assist people in achieving their service or their production objective goals, and that if people follow those, if the system had been perfectly anticipated, all that was left for people to do was to follow those rules and regulations to the letter, and then the system would be safe. So, in other words, we were talking about safety by the book. And since the perception was that we had designed perfect systems, the only thing we had to do was wait until somehow the system broke down and fix it. But that the system intrinsically and basically was a safe system. Now, any of us who have earned one day of his or her living in an operational situation might agree with me that most of the time in real life, the book goes out of the window. The heroic inventions that Jim has alluded to quite eloquently are a reflection of the realities of real life in aviation operations. Seldom things go by the book. But we didn't know that back in the 90s. And we didn't know that because, again, although we had a feeling out of personal experience that things don't always go by the book, this was a perception that was difficult to articulate. And most importantly, it was difficult to convey, because it's quite easy to say in a learned environment, well, you know, there is a message to violations. Violations are not necessarily bad things. There is a learning potential in violations. In learned context, that's a message that may be well received. Go and talk to a regulator about not punishing violations. So we were, again, like we were struggling towards the end of the 80s in terms of how the hell we address context. We were struggling by the mid-90s in terms of how do we address the realities of the context, not the theory of the context. And here is where another visual depiction came to assist us. There is the notion of the drift, the notion of the practical drift. And quite simple stated, you have at the system design stage, you want brainstorm possible interactions in the system you're about to deploy. You decide on the defenses that the system needs to achieve its objectives of production, and then you deploy technology, training, and regulations as the three basic defenses of the aviation system. Once you have that properly decided, you deploy the system in operation. You know, sometimes the system moves according to baseline performance, but other times baseline performance goes north, operational performance goes south. So what we effectively have, it's a drift between design and actual performance. And this has been called practical drift because it's a consequence of daily practice. It's a consequence of technology that doesn't operate the way that regulate the designer said it would perform. It is a consequence of training that is not complete enough to generate the operational behaviors that people need to operate the technology. It's a consequence of regulations that sometimes suck. And when I say regulations, I mean from the civil aviation regulations to standard operating procedures. Sometimes SOPs are wonderful in paper, and how many of us have been in the situation of thinking, I wish I had with me, in this particular situation, the individual who designed this SOP, so he can tell me how can I apply this SOP under this particular condition. Anyhow, the point is that people make system work in spite of those, all of these shortcomings. Again, these are the local inventions and the heroic interventions that, that Jim has alluded to in more than one of his. Now, there's nothing wrong with the drift as long as you control what happens within the drift. Because as we know, when we deploy local inventions, we don't have the big picture in front of us. We have a very narrow picture in front of us. And we might generate by our inventions system imbalances, which, if uncontrolled, will generate holes in the defenses and will eventually lead to an accident. So I guess that you realize, I hope, how important it is to capture formally what goes on within the drift. There is a negative learning potential, in a way, which is things people should not do. But there is also such a positive learning potential about the successful adaptations. And you know, I think we've all been through this one. You finish your whatever training, and you show up for work for the first day. And what does, if you're a pilot, what does the chap who's going to give you line indoctrination tells you? Well, kid, forget everything you learned in flight school. I'm going to teach you how to fly this airplane. That's the drift. It's not bad, as long as the organization keeps the drift under control, because those local inventions have a phenomenal potential of positive feed forward to the system. You might argue, we've been capturing the drift already. Yep, about there, with Axis Investigation. And really what we want to do, we want to capture the drift as close to its inception as possible. So when what this graphical depiction gave us was the tool to shift our thinking about how to capture context. And so what we did was we started thinking, well, we might not be able to fully anticipate all operational interactions within the system, but certainly we are able to anticipate some. So technology training and regulations provide a reasonable point of departure in order to manage the context. But we must keep in mind that safety vulnerabilities will remain, because we cannot anticipate all possible interaction, or safety vulnerabilities will arise as consequence of changes in the systems and whatnot. So we need to plan prescriptively, but the key point here is control of deviations during actual service delivery problems. The problems of safety in aviation are a consequence of the need to deliver a service. If we didn't have the need to deliver a service, we would have no problems in aviation. You are a recreational flyer, you have 3 knots of crosswind, you don't fly. There is no safety concern. So in this picture of performance-oriented context reading, the real concern are not deviations and violations, but losing control of the process of control of the deviations. So this leads us unavoidably, inexorably, to the need to monitor operations aimed at service delivery in real time. And it would seem to me that we have selected SMS as the tool for this monitoring. This is what we are, where we are at this point in time. So I liked, before I move to, this kind of wraps up my retrospective review of why we are where we are. And I like to underline once again that not one of these slides involves judgment, but a description of events the way I saw them. So let's turn the page and move to human factors and SMS. There are those who contend that quality is the predecessor of SMS. Respectfully, I beg to differ. I think that we have SMS today because we have human factors in the 80s. I think that human factors is the predecessor of SMS. So taking that into account, we have SMS today, we have human factors in the past, we have human factors today. The story of the deployment of human factors in aviation by any standard that you apply, it's one of unparalleled success, yet we did our mistakes. So what I like to do is I like to build on the mistakes that, with the benefit of hindsight, now we know we made during the deployment of human factors, so that we do not transpose them to the deployment of SMS. And I think that in addressing that bridge, I'll be able to address the contribution of the human factors community, the aviation human factors community, to the most efficient implementation of SMS. When we started getting involved in this human factor thing, we were constantly hearing this question that, you know, it's the same thing under this name. What's new about human factors? You know, we're talking about aviation medicine. We're talking about airmanship and things like that. Because human factors was the same thing under a different name, it was aviation medicine and aviation psychology, the people who should be tasked with deploying human factors should be physicians or psychologists. With human factors, we were faced with atypical contents. We were dealing with concepts and ideas which were somehow alien to the average professional, aviation professional. We needed to resort to constructs to explain some of these complexities. And we had our share of constructs in human factors. The mother of all construct was, something happened with the animation. Okay, let me build it this way then. If we said then that human factors was the same thing under a different name, now, we're talking about SMS, and we're hearing the same thing. SMS, it's the same thing under a different name. SMS, it's accident prevention under a different name. SMS is quality under a different name. And obviously, if that's the case, then those most aptly prepared to deploy SMS are actually investigators and quality practitioners. I was talking about construct. To me, the mother of all construct or father of all construct in aviation human factors was situational awareness. As useless a construct as we could have ever conceived. We invested millions of dollars in research on situational awareness. And you know what's the problem with constructs? That sometimes they lead to tautology. The accident was due to the fact that the crew lost situational awareness. Recommendation, crews are reminded not to lose their situational awareness. If we had researched interfaces, if we had invested our research dollars in interfaces instead of the constructs, we certainly would not have made many researches millionaires, but we still wouldn't have accidents as we have of airplanes falling out of the sky between of mode confusion. We have not mastered automation. We have learned to live with the flaws of automation. We have a young generation of aviation professionals which were born to the flaws of automation, and they know how to cope with it. But let's not think that we've solved the problem through situational awareness. We have our own construct in terms of SMS, which is just culture, and which has all the potential to lead to aberrations as much as situational awareness had. And I guess that, I'm sorry, guys, this is not the latest presentation, so I'm improvising. I really am. Something happened when the last presentation was loaded. I was going to refer, I had here one first slide about the confusion between human factors and human performance, which I hope it is still in the last slide of the presentation. But anyway, let me address these bridges, so to speak, to see what's the contribution of the human factor safety community to the deployment of SMS by looking at the differences. To those who say, well, you know, SMS, it's accident prevention on quality under a different name, here's the question. You get a call from your CEO or your director or whomever, and he says, I'm on my way to see the boss or the board of director. I need to tell me in 5 minutes what's the difference between SMS and what we're doing before. That's what the our cousins south of the border, you know, the colonials south of the Canadian border, they call the elevator version. So if you had to give the elevator version of SMS, it would be something like this. You know, you might hear that it's about changing culture and blah, 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 blah. It's simpler than that. You need to have a clear differentiation between a management system and an execution program. And what SMS is, it's a management system, and as such, it's a decision-making system. So what SMS is a management system which generates data for the organization, which allows strategic decision-makers to make strategic decisions. That's all it is. And once the decisions are made, they are implemented through execution programs. So SMS provides decision-making food for thought for senior managers. Those decisions are implemented through safety programs. That's the basic difference. So if you believe that SMS is yet another safety program, then of course it will be very difficult to articulate the difference between SMS and an accident prevention program. But what this would be, it's a way of justifying why we do things. And this is kind of a significant leap in thinking, because in aviation, historically, we think in terms of safety programs. We always deploy safety programs. We're not used to management. I'm talking about the operational level, which is this kind of operational audience. So that's to those who say it's the same thing under a different name, no, it isn't. It is a management system. And, you know, think about SMS as a box. And certainly there is an input to this box, which is data. And there is an output, which are safety decisions. And those safety decisions are implemented through safety programs. And if you would look at this slide, you would say, well, why would we deploy a threat and error management training program, a crew resource management training program, a CFIT, blah, 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 blah? Basically, because some bright guy in Montreal at ICAO thought that it was a good idea, your regulator did not oppose to it, or if it did, it lost the battle, so you've got to do it because it is the law. Now, do you have a problem of crew interactions in your organization, or are you implementing TEM or CRM simply because it is the law? So what this would look like is, based on this data input, which is not only operational, but it's broad nature data, you make decisions and then you say, I'm going to implement all these programs because the regulator demands that I do that. But I'm going to invest most of my training resources in TEM and CRM because that's what it hurts. And I'm going to invest less resources in CFIT and ALAR training because my data, the data of my organization, does not support the evidence of a major problem. And I'm not going to address runway safety to any large extent because we're operating on a low volume environment and long runways, and it seldom rains, Chile in South America. So what I'm saying is there are efficiencies to be gained out of this database organizational decision making which SMS proposes or generates. Now, this is essentially the beginning of SMS. This is where SMS starts. This is what is called safety risk management. And you might argue, but we've been doing this in the past. Indeed we have, but we've jumped direct to the safety programs. Mostly. We bypass the entire data collection and decision-making process. So this is one fundamental difference between SMS and what we used to do. But really the uniqueness of SMS, it's safety assurance. We have not made safety assurance in aviation except through active investigation, which is a very poor way of doing safety assurance. What we would normally do is we would do safety risk management. We start an operation in Innsbruck. We know it's a tough place, so we describe the system, you know, what the airport looks like, what are the facilities, blah, 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 blah. And then we look at what we have in our organization and what we need in order to safely operate in Innsbruck. So we do a hazard identification. We assess the consequences of the hazards, and so we do a safety risk assessment, and we deploy mitigations, procedures, the type of airplane we're going to fly in there, the type of technology, and we stop there. When we review these assumptions, when we have an accident, except if we have an accident or a serious incident, this is where the conventional safety program or the conventional approach to the management of safety stops. Under SMS, once you start your operation, once actual operations take place, you engage into safety assurance. So by continually monitoring safety performance, every time that your data shows that there are problems, you start the safety risk management process again. Every time that you have some change in the operation, you start the safety risk management process again. And every time, and you know, every time I push a button, I'm trembling to see what comes up. And every time that you engage into some corrective action, you go against into hazard identification to start the safety risk management again. So it becomes like a continuous process. And again, my argument is that in aviation, we've been extremely proficient in the past in doing the right-hand block, but we haven't done much in terms of the left-hand block. That's safety assurance. That's why we don't need, to the extent that some propose, quality assurance, because safety assurance takes over quality assurance. And this is really, if you're looking for a distinct mark of SMS as compared to the past, other than its nature of management system, it's safety assurance. It is indeed a new concept in the way we do business. So this would be safety risk management, and safety assurance completes the loop. What's the role of the human factors safety community in this entire process? I believe that TAM and CRM are significant data inputs to keep the process intact. But it's got to be data, which is data extracted from the operational context during delivery, during service delivery operations. Training data, like the American says, ain't no good. So this takes care of the first one. The second one would be the question of safety and quality. Air Vice Marshal Sir Hugh Downing was chief of fighter command during Battle of Britain. I don't think I need to mention that in this forum. Downing was a contemporaries and history alike somehow criticized Downing by his indecisiveness to commit resources unless the odds were completely in his favor. There's this story that he was briefing Sir Winston Churchill, and Churchill couldn't get the straight answer from Downing. And at a point in time, the ifs, and Churchill said, "Downing, the terrible ifs accumulate. We will never make a decision." There are some terrible ifs that we need to clarify in this question of SMS or QMS, because otherwise we might get into an adversarial type of situation that will do no good to no one. So the two basic questions are, if I have QMS, do I need SMS? Of course you do. There's no question about it. Because quality is about defects during production. Safety is about hazards during service delivery. So does Boeing or Airbus or Embraer, do they need an SMS? They do. Because a depressurization alarm, which sounds exactly as a takeoff configuration alarm, it's not a defect. So for quality, that would be okay. But certainly operational experience might suggest that same alarm for two significantly different operational considerations may be a hazard. Now, if you are a service delivery organization, an airline, a traffic control organization, do you need quality? Yes, of course you need quality, but not for safety. For safety, you need to identify hazards. And the organizational system which will allow you to identify hazard, it's SMS. And the other terrible question is, if I have a prevention officer in the organization, I have a quality manager, do I need a safety manager? Of course you do. Of course you do. You know, it's a question of beliefs driving behavior. Prevention officers are mostly ex-investigators by history, trade, education, background, are geared towards the probable cause. And in collecting data during service delivery operations and in making safety decisions based on that data, the probable cause has nothing to do, number one. Number two, under an SMS environment, the role of the safety manager will change in a significant manner. The safety manager today is the person who finds the problem, provides the solution, and monitors that the solution works. Under an SMS environment, the safety manager will generate the data, will put the data in the hands of those who provide the service, that is the director for flight operations, the director for training, whomever, and will simply tell him or tell her, look, the data suggests that you have a problem. I have no idea about flight operations. I only know about data. You know about flight operations. You fix the problem. Oh, by the way, don't reply to me. Reply to the CEO. So it's a significant way of doing business in terms of safety. And although it is a generalization, I don't honestly believe that the prevailing generation of accident investigators are trained as they are to do this task. This doesn't mean that they cannot be trained. But all I'm saying is, if you simply have an accident investigator as your prevention officer, okay, under SMS, I'm going to give the responsibility of SMS to this fellow, it may not work. It may not work. Quality, I don't think I think I don't even need to discuss that. Quality, people are geared towards compliance. And we're not talking about compliance here. In fact, under an SMS, compliance is a lesser concern because we're concerned about deviations, not about compliance. So that's number two. What's our contribution, the contribution of the aviation human factor safety community to this dilemma? I'm kind of showing my bias here. But I think that any aviation human factors professional who has gone through our generation is much better qualified to become a safety manager under SMS than an accident investigator, no question. If we make the jump to the contextual reading, important caveat. So the last one. I didn't want to go through this. I'm going to skip it. This is bad. Right. Let me go through the last one, I think it is, in this version. The question of the just culture. A couple of things. First of all, there are pros and cons in constructs. Constructs help us reduce complexity to manageable size on the one hand, but the cons of construct is, like I said, it generally they lead to tautology. They lead to kind of circular actions. So that's a precaution that we have to take. And then any time that we resort to construct. Number two, this just culture thing reflects the Anglo-Saxon view of the world. Basically, what he's saying is, in order to achieve an objective, you need to you need to engage in certain processes. You need to not punish people. You need to blah, 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 blah. But most of those processes are processes which are rather achievable in an Anglo-Saxon environment, but are quite unachievable in other environments. So by specifying a set of predetermined steps, we're getting to a... we're getting to a situation where we're telling people what to do and how to do it. And we're generating a situation where those who cannot do what they are supposed to do may be branded as having an unjust culture. That's a long shot, indeed. So I guess we need to walk the talk here. What we're trying to achieve through this just culture thing is we're trying to capture operational data. We are trying to capture what goes on within the drift. So my point would be, we might be better served if we leave this notion of the contract aside and we set the objective. Get data through any ways that you can get the data. But as long as you get the data, you have the right culture. And again, what's the contribution of the human factors community to this? Very few communities have the expertise that we have developed in terms of collection and analysis of data on human performance. We need to broaden that to capture human performance within the drift. So I'm going to skip this again because it's not what I wanted to say. And I'm going to steal you a minute, Jim. I'm going to take three instead of two. Because I'm heading into the sunset. This is more than likely my last visit to the Royal Aeronautical Society. So I like to engage on a personal recognition, and please bear with me, chaps. As most of you know, or some of you know, no formal education. I jumped out of high school into flight training. That's where my formal education started, stopped. I'm not a high school dropout because my father wouldn't allow me to, because otherwise I would have dropped high school to go into flying earlier. But I was incredibly lucky because I had as personal tutors the two most brilliant minds that aviation safety has produced over the last 20 years. I think this combination of Jim and Bob and Jim, but I don't need to introduce Jim. The other chap in the picture is Professor Robert Hemright. Bob and Jim have been a phenomenal one, too. And I think that when the history of aviation safety in the last 20 years of the 20th century is written, I think that Bob and Jim should be at the level of, you know, the Boffins of World War II who invented radar, or Sir Frank Whittle. I'm serious. Don't laugh. I'm serious. What Jim did was, Jim gave us the concepts that we needed to understand the complexity of the situation in facing ever-increasing difficulties. What Bob did was, Bob put data to those concepts. So it was a terrible combination. It couldn't be any better. Why the Australians suppose that I had to be in the picture, it beats me. But then, you know, Australians are weird, so shouldn't surprise that. But let me close by saying, Jim and Bob, whatever you are, it's been a privilege meeting you. It's been a privilege enjoying your company, your wisdom, and your witticism over the last 20 years. God bless you. Gentlemen, ladies, thank you very much.